Hi everyone, welcome back to Polemics Rec, the entirely student-run podcast from the Diplomatic Academy of Vienna. I'm Mariam Sindhi, your host for this episode, and I'm also editor-in-chief at Polemics Magazine, our institution's student-run publication. I'm very honored today to welcome a distinguished guest, the former Prime Minister of Ireland, Bertie Ahern, who joins us to reflect on his peace-building career, nearly 26 years after his pivotal role in negotiating the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, which effectively brought an end to the Troubles, 3 decades of violence that had grappled Northern Ireland since the late 1960s. Thank you for joining us today,
Bertie. Thank you very much, Marianne.
Before diving into your role in negotiating the Good Friday Agreement, could you characterize your time in office and maybe highlight the experiences that shaped your approach to leadership?
Well, I was lucky, Marianne, that I was in the Parliament for almost 35 years, and I spent 20 of that between Prime Minister and Minister for Employment or Minister for Labour, as they say in some countries, and Minister of Finance for 20 years. So I had a long run in government. And I suppose in a lot of that period, I was involved in negotiations of one kind or another. In Ireland, we had a very difficult economic situation in the late 70s after the oil crisis and into the 80s. And we had our own financial difficulties in those early 80s. So it was decided that rather than having constant strikes and labour difficulties with the social partners, the farmers, the employers, the trade unions, that we should try and negotiate economic programmes, social partnership programmes with the various sectors of society. So, from 87 on, I was every 3 years we negotiated programmes. So I'd been involved in almost constant negotiations and trying to negotiate programmes and then implementing them and getting ready for the next one. So I did that for a number of years. And then I was Minister of Finance on 3 separate occasions and in the 90s, very closely together before I was Prime Minister. So I'd been my party chief whip in government and in opposition. So I've been around for a long time. So it's always a good education in politics that you don't come up too fast. You learn your battles along the way, which I certainly did. But I think from the 90s, the time I was Minister of Finance, we got the name of the Celtic Tiger, which I'm not sure was good or bad, but anyway, because it builds up a lot of views on people of what you can do, and people think we're very rich all of a sudden, which of course was never true in a small country of 4 million people. So expectations always rise. It was a good period because we came from a very difficult position. When I was Minister for Employment first, we had 20% unemployment and huge emigration. Every year, the labour market was growing by about 2.5% and immigration was 2.5%. So it was very difficult times. And I was right through that to a period where we had only 2 or 3% unemployment. It was an interesting time to be in government, an interesting time to be across so many changes in our society.
Definitely an interesting time to be in government and an interesting legacy you left with the agreement. How do you reflect on it now, and how do you look back on the success in bridging the differences among all the different actors?
Yeah, well, I was talking earlier on today with our ambassador here, Ambassador Ron O'Leary, who's a lot of experience and I worked with in the early years. I think the good thing from our point of view, looking back now, is that we have almost no violence. Little or nothing. Any violence that we have nowadays is really around drug crime, which happens everywhere and happens in my own city in Dublin as much as anywhere else. So Northern Ireland is probably a more peaceful place than most cities in Europe, because they're trying to catch up and they're trying to develop and they're building up their 2 fine universities, Queen's University and Ulster University, who are now really expanding and growing. And young people are not leaving Northern Ireland now near as much. They're staying on for their own education there. A lot of foreign direct investment coming into Northern Ireland. It's particularly became a hub for AI, for artificial intelligence, which is Not too sure how that's happened, but it's happened. So that's wonderful news for them. And they it's a far cost base. It's a far cheaper place in Northern Ireland than most other cities because the years of pent up conflict that created so many problems for them. And they have a huge amount of bright young graduates. So it's doing very well. So I think looking back as we do, it's to be able to see that, you know, the violence ceased effectively. There's been very little violence in the last 25 years, a few incidents. But since the Omagh bombing in 1998, there's been little or nothing. And all the parties, we've had ups and downs politically. Political stability has been more difficult in Northern Ireland because the form that we did in the negotiations that Tony Blair and I did was that there is no opposition. Everybody is kind of in government because we had to try and make a shared, since it was a shared problem, we had to try and make a shared society and to set up institutions where everybody worked together. Now, there are some parties now in the new arrangement that are in opposition, but for the last 25 years, it was kind of, if it was cross community, it was Catholic Protestants, it was nationalist, unionist, Republican, loyalist. So if anyone was against the agreement, they could bring down the whole agreement. It's not an ideal solution, but it was the only way that we could get everyone to work, so that everyone would buy into the agreement. But it's back up working again. But even when it wasn't working, you know, Northern Ireland has been growing and prospering, population rising, and away from what was, you know, 30 years of hell every day in Ireland. And it affected, of course, the whole island of Ireland. It wasn't just Northern Ireland. They got most of the brunt of it. But every day the news was, what bombs were there today? You know, who was shot today? What damage was done to some building today? What funerals were on? What do religious leaders say at various funerals? And of course, you know, that affected massively on society. Young people emigrated to universities in different parts of the world, not only in England and Scotland and Wales. It was impossible to get foreign direct investment. It was hard enough to hold the businesses that were there. So it was a very trying period. So for the time I was leaving school and second level to the time I was Prime Minister, that it went on to that whole stretch. And you know, if the same number of people had have died pro rata in the United States, it would have been a quarter of a million people, because Northern Ireland is a small place and the areas of conflict were even smaller again. The great thing as we look back now is to see the progress that's been made, you know, the peace working. But it's all conflicts. You know, the day you start believing everything is perfect is the day you'll regret, because you always have to. And the governments now, the institution now, they have to keep on working and keep on reinvigorating yourself. I always fear that, you know, a new generation will come up who don't remember the killings and the murders and the mayhem, and might feel that, you know, it's not necessary to have the same intensity of watching it and negotiating. But I think so far so good. There are a new generation coming up and, you know, young, bright, intelligent people who I think will take forward the process. And if they do that, Northern Ireland has a really bright future, because Brexit was a disaster for Northern Ireland. It really cost us 6 or 7 years of you know, not violence, thankfully, but problems and difficulties and tensions and, you know, arguments about everything and anything that we just didn't need after years of conflict, decades of conflict, but really hundreds of years of conflict if you take in the Irish issue. But now where we've got ourselves to is that Northern Ireland has it's part of the internal British economy. For goods, it's part of the European economy. And of course, it has the island economy. So if it's used right, and I think after 8 years of trying since Brexit, I think we've convinced people that there is a real opportunity and investment. And we've got a lot of help from the United States. Joe Kennedy, a relation of the former president, famous Kennedy's name, he's been acting as economic envoy. And that's been very helpful. He's working directly to Joe Biden. So hopefully for the rest of this year, we'll see what happens after it.
And of course, various conflict zones often look at the success of peace efforts in your country as a sort of blueprint that maybe they can follow. Do you think that sometimes power sharing arrangements can potentially cause new issues? For instance, with nationalists and unionists sharing power, there's an observation that perhaps it doesn't allow room for more moderates down the middle.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth in that. What we had to do in 1997, 98, when Tony Blair and I were working at this every day, we'd been working at it in opposition, 94, 95, 96. And our first task was to try and stop the violence. Was to see what could we do to convince people that there was another way. That it didn't have to be out of a barrel of a gun or a carload of Semtex, and that there was another way of doing things. And that was the first and biggest task. And then the second task was to get people to sign up to what became known as the Mitchell Principles. And that basically said you can't shoot your way to the negotiating table. You must stop the violence before you can be part of the process. Now, that was iffy because it'd be great if that was black and white, but when you're dealing with paramilitary organisations, they're not armies, so people don't totally control things. They control things to a great extent, but not totally. So we had to try and get that. And then we had to convince people that they could. A lot of these people hated each other, quite frankly. It wasn't that they just didn't tolerate each other, they hated each other. So you had to make them believe that they could take Northern Ireland forward and that they could work together and that they could actually sit down and start dealing with the real issues of life, which is jobs, education, environmental, climate change, infrastructure. And that was a hell of a task because even though they were good politicians, they'd been involved in the conflict so much and their lives had been involved in the conflict that they found it hard to move into mainstream political activities. Some of them had served in Europe and some of them served in the British Parliament, but others hadn't served anywhere. That took a lot of effort. So I think I never put forward our process as a blueprint for anywhere, because every conflict is different. No two conflicts are the same. But there are certain things that I think are probably worth looking at in any conflict. And I think in our case, the inclusive power sharing, bringing everyone together, worked. Will it work forever? I don't think so. I think there's more or less an agreement, and a bit more or less, it's not total, but that they will look at this and review. So as you've said, Marianne, that new parties, kind of more moderate parties that would see themselves having not been involved in the conflict, that they might make the changes. I'd love to see that happen. I don't want them to try it tomorrow because it wouldn't work tomorrow, but I would like to see it into the future.
And how much of the ability to come to such an agreement do you think can be credited to the stars sort of aligning in terms of the leadership that was really pushing the peace process?
Sometimes people say, oh, the reason we were succeeded in 97, 98 was that people were exhausted from the conflict. Well, I think they were exhausted from 1978, so I don't think that was the reason. I think we were lucky that there were brave people prepared to look at alternatives, and there were other people at least had open minds and were prepared, to take a chance. And I think we were lucky, I suppose, in that Bill Clinton was in the White House, Tony Blair was in number 10, I was in Dublin. We were, not too much difference in age. All three of us were mad enough to give it a try. And I think that was, that was kind of lucky. And then we had a lot of help, obviously, from the European Union, who were giving money towards peace initiatives. And, I think we got a lot of help in that President Clinton gave us George Mitchell, who was a very able, diplomatic, highly intelligent, driven person who had the patience of Jove. He was able to pull this together and work with us. But I think in the end of the day, you have to give credit to them all, because when you're trying to bring people in who have been out in violence and shooting and organising, you know, a military campaign and you know, wrecking each other and killing each other, and to convince them that there is another way. I mean, you need a bit of a look too. And I think the world was changing as well. I think after 9/11, Afghanistan, American War on Terror, you know, people started reflecting on some of these things. So you need a lot of things to come right to get a chance. But even that, I think people probably reflect back on the Northern Ireland peace process, because I think the UN have a document out. There's been 40 or 50 conflicts in these last 30 or 40 years. I think Northern Ireland's about the only one that's actually been a success. And that's a success that's each day you have to keep working on it, because you wouldn't need to be counting your chickens.
Prime Minister, many people view the signing of the Good Friday Agreement as potentially a bridge towards a united Ireland. Do you see that as a possibility in your lifetime?
Well, it's a possibility, yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have got an agreement if there wasn't a clause in that on another day there would be referendums to see whether people wanted to stay with the Union or wanted a united Ireland. I tend to argue that it's not united Ireland, it's a new Ireland, because I think the generations have changed from where it was 100 years ago when people kind of invented the term united Ireland. So I think you'd have to be a new Ireland that would have a comprehensive range of agreements that would bring in unionists and loyalists with nationalists and republicans, and that would make it a new society where they could all buy into. That, I think, will be tried. Once it's a democratic vote, people will decide yes or no. I don't think it'll happen this decade, quite frankly. There's a huge amount of work to do. But I do think that work is more or less started. It's underway. I think it'll turn into two camps. There will be those who will argue that the union is the right thing for Northern Ireland for the future, and those that will argue that it's to join into a new Ireland. And that will become a democratic vote somewhere. I don't know when, but it is part of the agreement. It has to happen. And once it's not pushed too soon, I think it's the best way to deal with it.
Thank you, Prime Minister. You mentioned earlier that there was really this leap of faith with yourself, with Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Clinton's diplomatic interest in building peace. In recent years, the world has faced renewed challenges to international stability. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, for instance, has vividly reminded Europe that the state of peace can be difficult to reach. How do you view these current events with a peace-building lens? Do you see negotiation possibilities?
I used to say when I was Minister for Labour and Employment, I said every strike that starts has to end. Sometimes the end means the company closes and all the labourers lose their jobs. So it's not always a happy ending. Most times, but there's a negotiated settlement. But those who think it's always a happy ending would need to think long and hard. Right now, it's hard to see what the solution is. But I've no doubt somewhere diplomatic efforts will have to prevail, and there will have to be a settlement. But as we speak, there doesn't seem to be any inclination by either side, and particularly not by Putin, to work for any solution. From my reading of it, he seems to be playing a long game. I always thought that's what he would do. You know, he doesn't have to worry about the editorial writers or the political correspondents questioning judgments or questioning decisions. You know, Ukraine do, because the people are supporting them are all in democratic countries, most of them, and they're answerable to free elections. So, you know, the sides are very different, and for that reason, they're very much apart. So I'd love to see on the horizon an early solution, but I don't see that. And I just hope that the world and that helped Ukraine, a democratic country who've been illegally invaded, breaking every law in the book, that they continue to be supported by the rest of the world. And nobody would be happier than if I thought tomorrow morning that there would be a talk starting to try and resolve it. But I think you'd be very naive to think that's going to happen.
And in your experience building peace, do you think of peace as a destination or more of a work in progress?
I think it's work in progress. We had two world wars and endless conflicts down through history. And there's always work in progress. I don't think there's a perfect solution. I remember a university once, I won't mention the university, but University of the United States, a very powerful one that narrows it down for you, asked me to, would I take part in an academic study to write a book on how you solve conflicts. And I said, well, I'll take part in the academic study, all right, but I don't think it'll be much good to anyone if they want to solve conflicts, because conflicts are complex, they're different. You can't have a textbook answer for conflicts. And we produced a book, but I don't think it's been worth much.
And what would be your advice to leaders in conflict zones today?
People have to decide. The first thing you have to decide in conflicts, and I've tested, I've been involved in lots of places, you know, from the Basque country to, I was involved in Ukraine and Maidan in the early years. In Donbass, I was through that region at that time with working with President Ahtisaari, former President Finland. And, you know, in the conflicts in Papua New Guinea, where 25,000 people were killed in a few years and slaughtered by various groups, on the Bougainville issue. But, you know, you have to look at the warring factions, and the first question they have to answer, are they happy with the status quo? Are they happy with the situation where thousands of their people or the people who are their neighbours, maybe were their friends, which is a Ukraine example where a lot of people were very friendly together. Are they happy with that status quo? Are they happy with bombings and shootings and killings and murder and mayhem and people being savaged? Or do they want to try something else? And I think if people believe that the status quo is okay, well, peacemakers, you know, should go home and have a cup of tea, because there's not much they can do. But if they believe, which they should believe, that the status quo is not tenable, then you can start looking at solutions and models and solutions, and you can start looking at, you know, what are the objectives of each side, what are their aspirations, where there's common ground. Tony Blair and I used to say, if we could get one little thing that they would agree on, then we could bank that. And I always negotiate with unions and everyone else, employers, all my life and years at it now, that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. But you have to start somewhere. Yeah. You have to start and say, well, can we agree that it's today, and build on it from that? But it's there's nothing easy, but it is possible. It is possible to build confidence and to try and build trust. And many times then you have to try and get at the people in the country to explain why it is or what you're trying to do. And that's not easy, because some people don't seem to want to find solutions. You have to try and get at maybe the people they represent, that there isn't another way of doing things.
Thank you so much, Prime Minister, for taking the time to speak with us today and for giving us some insight into how peace can be possible if you have the vision to see peace as a possibility. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.